From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. The pressure's been building and building. NFL onlookers are concerned that pro football will explode, and man, what a mess that will make. Ahead on Only a Game, Tom Brady and Roger Goodell ramp up the apparently interminable Deflategate drama. Also, the debate over whether the Department of Defense should pay for soldiers and veterans to be honored at sporting events. And we remember pioneering auto racer, journalist, and photographer Denise McCluggage. Also coming up, a new biography of Ty Cobb aims to set the record straight regarding the Georgia Peaches' image as a tyrant and a racist.
He never said anything about race until 1952, when he told the Sporting News that the Negro has the right to play professional sports, and who's to say he has not?
Stay tuned. If you've been hoping for closure in the NFL's Deflategate saga, you are out of luck. Probably way out of luck. Super Bowl MVP Tom Brady is appealing his four-game suspension. The New England Patriots once pledged to accept the findings of attorney Ted Wells' investigation, but now the team has created a website to challenge, in great, even exhausting detail, the Wells report. It's not certain that cooler heads will prevail. So we turn to the Wall Street Journal's exceedingly cool columnist, Jason Gay. Jason, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. And, you know, cooler heads, if left outside in 30-degree weather, will even deflate further. I want you to be certain of that.
Ah, science.
Yes.
In a column published on Monday, you imagined a scenario where Tom Brady accepts his suspension and spends the month of September relaxing, probably in a hammock outside a classic Maine farmhouse while sipping an old-fashioned. I assume that you're disappointed that's not going to happen. Brady is lawyered up.
I'm sure the Patriots and I'm sure Tom Brady are very concerned about the reputational damage here. They would probably like to not have to relinquish those draft picks or that $1 million. But Tom Brady is a 38-year-old man, and if we look at professional sports nowadays, we have seen in repeated instances, look at LeBron James taking 2 weeks off in the NBA season, The San Antonio Spurs, they practically send everybody on a spa weekend every other day. It might be just the shot in the arm that he needs physically. I know all of New England is ready to march on down to the NFL office and demand to get Tom Brady back for the season opener. But, you know, long view here, Bill. You know, we want to have this guy around for 4 or 5 more years in New England, don't they?
Jason, you also wrote, the Patriots versus the NFL versus the NFL's overwrought self-regard is a drama especially depleted in lovable protagonists. Does anybody in this end up looking good?
Not really. Not really. And can we talk about what the Patriots did? You know, their kind of point-by-point rebuttal of the Wells report. There was a brilliant excuse in there with regard to what the deflator text means. The Patriots are stipulating that deflator in these texts refers not to any sort of monkey business with regard to footballing, but with regard to weight gain and weight loss, that these gentlemen like to get in the weight room. They sometimes bulk up a little too hard, and they like to bring that weight down, thus deflating themselves. Now, listen, Bill, when I was a young man growing up in Massachusetts, you know, before the age of 17, a friend and I went out for a few beers, and I hid a six-pack underneath the bed in my room, which my mother found. She looked at me, and she said, I can't believe you did this. Why did you do this? And I said, Mom, I am saving these beer bottles for a close friend of mine who's become a beer bottle collector. And my mom looked at me and laughed so hard that she just, at that point, couldn't punish me. And I kind of feel like that might be the Patriot strategy here.
I want to know if they're going to stand by this deflate means weight loss strategy, why those guys were suspended.
Right. If that's the case, if these guys were simply just trying to lose a few pounds, Bill,
yeah,
which probably all can, why are they out of a job? Also, Bill, who is the first person to open up a chain of fitness establishments in the greater New England area called Deflators?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
It's just a $1 million idea waiting to happen.
Maybe you and I should just go ahead and do it after we're finished with this conversation.
That's right. They're like, Bill and Jason, whatever happened to those guys? Well, have you ever heard of Deflators? Oh, my gosh. Wow. 1,500 gyms all around the world.
We learned on Thursday night that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell will hear Tom Brady's appeal himself. Goodell could have chosen somebody else to review the case. Are you surprised that he didn't do that?
No, I'm not surprised. But if we're going to be forced to watch four rounds of the NFL draft live on TV, if we're going to have regional combines televised, can we have this on TV? Can NFL Network show this? You know, pre-hearing show, maybe a musical guest, you know, get Keith Urban in there to do a song. I think the NFL is leaving a lot of money on the table, not optimizing this for network TV.
Jason, the NFL has had many public relations failures in the past year or so. Most of them, all of them, dealt with issues much, much more serious than the air pressure of a football. But Deflategate helped make the Super Bowl one of the most talked about in years. It now has us discussing the NFL in mid-May with no mention of concussions. At some level, isn't this a masterstroke of self-promotion?
The one thing that we have learned through all of these travails, all of this sort of ham-handed bureaucratic management, mismanagement, failure to understand societal opinions about things, is that football always figures out a way to win. You only have to look at that Brady suspension. He's going to miss four games. That puts him back on the field October 18th in where, Bill? Where are they going to be playing? Indianapolis. The Colts, who yapped to the league office and got this whole thing started. That is a revenge game? You know, it's as if they script this thing long in advance. It is just so absurd. And you mentioned the sort of seriousness that the NFL has been through. There are a lot of reasons to be very agitated about football and certainly the future of football. I think anytime you're able to discuss something at, like, you know, deflated footballs, I think they welcome that kind of conversation. I think they cherish the ability to continue the football talk outside of the regular season.
Jason Gay writes for The Wall Street Journal, and you can link to his column, The NFL Dares to Sit Tom Brady, at onlyagame.org. Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Have a great day.
What went on behind closed doors as Commissioner Goodell pondered punishing the Patriots? Go to onlyagame.org for an exclusive expose. Well, not an expose exactly. We kind of made it up. Denise McCluggage died last week at the age of 88. She was an accomplished skier, but she found even more speed behind the wheel of a race car. She was also a journalist and a photographer. When she was inducted into the Automotive Hall of Fame, she told the crowd that her life hadn't gone exactly as planned.
So there I was playing with cars and putting my life on hold. And I thought, well, that's funny. I missed out what I was supposed to do.
Those who knew McCluggage would say that she missed out on very little. Here's her longtime friend and fellow automotive journalist, Gene Jennings.
If I really try to talk about the loss, I don't think I can talk for long. Denise McCluggage was my hero. She was my heroine. She was a journalist. She was a brilliant journalist, and she was a really good racing driver and the foremost woman driver of her day, which was the late 50s and early 60s. You know, I think she started her life as a sports reporter and maybe one of the first women sports reporters in New York, and she was covering racing and just decided she would try it herself. She was gorgeous. She was hot. And her helmet had pink polka dots on it. And it was just like her. Just like her, you know? She was not a girly girl, but she was a gorgeous girl. She was racing on all the most incredible tracks and venues of the day against the greatest drivers as well. At the same time, she was a brilliant writer. And I don't think there is a person in our business who's really fit to hold her pen. I was about 26 years old. I had just started at Car and Driver magazine, and I had gone on a press trip to Washington, D.C. with Volkswagen, and I was in my room, and they had a list of all the journalists, and I saw her name, and I got really excited and called her room, and she was writing for Auto Week, and there I was, this new woman, you know, more of a girl. And we were friends ever since. She made everyone around her feel loved and feel adored in her presence. She made you feel loved and you loved to be with her. She was close to everyone, everyone in the day. She was close to Miles Davis. She lived in the same apartment building, and so they used to hang out together and talk about cars. She did exactly what she wanted to do and did what she loved. And she did it all with joy. She didn't wear her femaleness like a sword and shield. Feminist, I don't even think about it that way. I think of her as, you know, sort of rising up above everybody. At the age of 86, she was teaching old guys how to drive their Porsches for $1,000 a day. She was still terrifying people on the track or even on the road because she was so fast and so good. And that never seemed to dim. She just hated being infirm in any way. And she hated any slowing down whatsoever. So she said, they found a tumor in my left kidney and I'm not going to have it operated on. We went to her house. She was beat up because she had pneumonia. We sat down for a dinner around her table. She started telling stories. It was hours. We were there hours. And halfway into it, I thought, why am I not running a tape recorder? I just wanted to be there and hear her stories. By Sunday morning when I woke up, I was distraught that I had just gone through 3 hours and I couldn't remember anything she said. We came back in the morning and she was wearing a sweatshirt that said, with age comes oldness. She said, yeah, I got it online. She was just the best. I said, Denise, we're going to make a little video and I'll get you started. And it was her name.
So Denise, you've been called Mick Luggage.
Well, also, when I was in school, ninth graders thought it was very funny to call me Mac Baggage. And I finally came up with my real name is Valise McPortmanteau. It is French, and you wouldn't understand.
Her giggle is absolutely famous. It was almost like she had just thought of the joke and laughed before it came out of her mouth. It was just classic. I cannot believe it, but 3 days later, she was gone. 3 days later, she was gone. And I know God is good, but this was about the biggest blessing I think I've ever had in my life. Not just knowing her, but like being there, representing a lot of people who love her and really, you know, worship the pen she used to write.
Jean Jennings is the founder and editor-in-chief of JeanKnowsCars.com. Her remembrance of Denise McLuggage was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. The WNBA has been reviewing the decision of James Dolan, owner of the New York Knicks and WNBA's New York Liberty, to put Isaiah Thomas in charge of the women's team. Neither WNBA president Laurel Richie nor the Liberty chose to comment for this story, but it's not hard to imagine what objections the league might have to bringing Thomas on board as team president, though as a player with the Detroit Pistons, he was something special.
His highlight reel in the playoffs would be second only to Michael Jordan's.
That's longtime basketball writer and columnist Bob Ryan, who covered the NBA during Thomas's entire career, which began in 1981 and ended in 1994.
When he was in the so-called zone, I don't think there was ever a more proficiently dynamic little man to play the game than Isaiah Thomas.
Thomas goes for three and hits it. What a third quarter for Isaiah Thomas. He has scored 21 points here in the third to bring the Pistons all even at 77.
Thomas's Hall of Fame playing career did not translate into success as a coach and basketball executive. As the general manager of the Toronto Raptors, he drafted some talented players but struggled to get along with coaches and business partners. He left the team in 1998, 4 years after he'd arrived. It was the beginning of what SB Nation writer Roger Sherman recently described as a string of failures.
He's had several jobs at several different levels of the sport in several roles, and he's been pretty bad at all of them. Everywhere he went, he left a steaming pile of rubble in his wake.
One of the most dramatic of those failures was Thomas's ill-fated acquisition of the Continental Basketball Association. He bought the entire league for $9 million in 1999. According to Sherman, Thomas had convinced the team owners that he could build the minor league that had been entertaining fans and sometimes developing NBA players since 1946 into a bigger, better business. In 2001, the CBA declared bankruptcy and ceased operations. The New York Times called the debacle a case study in how not to run a business. Thomas left the CBA to coach the Indiana Pacers, who'd made the NBA Finals just before he arrived. In his first year on the job, the team dropped to 41-41. In 3 years there, Thomas never won more than 48 games, Immediately after he left, the Pacers won 61 games. Then, remarkably, he was hired as general manager of the New York Knicks, which Roger Sherman tries to explain.
The thing that stands out to me is everyone seems to trust him. He convinces people to believe in him. And time and time again, he does nothing for these people.
In New York, the man inclined to trust Isaiah Thomas was the owner of the Knicks, James Dolan, who also owns the Liberty and Madison Square Garden, and who has just hired Thomas again. Under Thomas, the Knicks ascended to the NBA's highest payroll and descended to the league's second worst record. But that was just bad business. Thomas also was charged with sexually harassing one of the women with whom he worked. Recently appearing on ESPN's Mike and Mike show, Thomas called the judgment against him into question.
I will continue to address him. I've always maintained my innocence. And if people want to continue to believe in the falsities, I can't speak to that. I can only speak to the facts.
One of the facts is that several witnesses contradicted Thomas's claim of innocence. Another fact is that James Dolan and his corporation, MSG, ended up paying $11.5 million to Thomas's accuser. Among those who've opined this week that putting Isaiah Thomas in charge of the New York Liberty is a singularly bad idea are Ann Donovan, head coach of the WNBA's Connecticut Sun, and the all-female ownership group of the Seattle Storm. Roger Sherman's explanation for the hiring, the man who has signed and may once again be signing Isaiah Thomas's checks.
I don't think there's anyone besides James Dolan currently who would give him a job. I have sincere best wishes for the New York Liberty who have to work with Isaiah Thomas.
The Liberty begins playing preseason games on May 22nd. Whether Isaiah Thomas will be in charge of the team by that time depends upon how much power James Dolan has in the WNBA. Ty Cobb retired as baseball's all-time hits leader in 1928, and the record stood for nearly 60 years. He was a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame's first class, but despite his success, Cobb was far from universally admired.
Ty Cobb, he was a racist. I threw him out three times in Cuba. He quit. He said, no, throw me out. But I said, I've thrown you out.
Ted Double Duty Radcliffe told me that story one afternoon at Comiskey Park in Chicago back in 1997. Radcliffe was a talented pitcher and catcher in the Negro Leagues from the 1920s to the 1940s. He faced Cobb in an exhibition in Cuba, and he wasn't the only person to label Ty Cobb a racist. In biographies and magazine stories, Cobb has been accused of beating up black men simply because they were black and handy. In a new book titled Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, Charles Learson presents a different picture of one of the greatest ballplayers of all time. Mr. Learson, welcome to Only a Game.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's go back to when you first started doing research for this book. You assumed that the stories about Ty Cobb being a racist were probably true. Was Ted Radcliffe wrong?
Yeah. The short answer is I'd like to see some dates and times on that, and I'd like to know the demeanor. I mean, and I should say right at the onset that Ty Cobb's reputation, his bad reputation, really started in earnest after his death in 1961 mm-hmm. and based on no new evidence. But a lot of people have made assumptions about Cobb based on the date of his birth and the location, which is 1886 in Royston, Georgia, or near Royston, Georgia. And so people just assume he must have been a racist. But what they don't know, and what I found out, is that he descends from a long line of abolitionists. He never said anything about race until 1952, when he told the Sporting News that the Negro has the right to play professional sports, he said, and who's to say he has not?
Tell us a story that was widely accepted about Cobb that you discovered to be false.
Apart from the racism, I mean, one thing is about the spiking. When he came up in 1905, spikes were fascinating to people in that era. They were sort of, I don't know, medieval or futuristic, all rolled into one. You know, they were this weird thing. And I found articles in the paper saying people are going to be killed because of spikes. Mm. But a guy named Germany Schaefer, who was his teammate, said, Cobb is a good, solid guy. He's never hurt a man. And people who put on spikes for a living understand that.
Cobb's most notorious biographer was a sports writer and author named Al Stump, and he was assigned by a publisher to work with Cobb on an as-told-to autobiography late in Cobb's life. Tell us how that played out.
He connected with Cobb, who was very sick at that time. Stump later wound up saying he spent months and months with Cobb. Actually, he spent a few days with Cobb. Stump went off and wrote, making up quotes, making up incidents. And he didn't want to show it to Cobb. He was holding out, hoping Cobb would die first. Cobb finally got a look at it and went nuts and tried to get it stopped. But he died. The book came out. Then Stump wrote an article. This is the real beginning of the myth, mm-hmm. in which he depicted Cobb as a drunken, gun-toting, crazy man. It was shocking to people, and they loved the idea of a monster in the baseball world.
Some of the stories that Al Stump invented about Ty Cobb formed the basis of the 1994 movie titled Cobb, directed by Ron Shelton. Here's Tommy Lee Jones as Cobb explaining what should be in the biography.
What people want to know about is Tyrus Raymond Cobb. And they don't want to know who he hates because everybody hates somebody. They don't care if he had two wives or ten or if he hit women or women hit him.
Well, you think they want to know how to steal second base?
Yes, precisely.
Did anybody connected with the making of that movie ever say, hey, wait a minute, was Ty Cobb really that crazy?
No, as a matter of fact, they fanned the flames of that myth. I actually interviewed Ron Shelton, the director of that movie. He said to me, you know, it's a known fact that Cobb killed as many as three people. I said, where'd you get that from? He said, it's a known fact. He just fell back upon that.
Wow.
There's a scene in the movie in which Cobb tries to rape a cigarette girl and fails because he's so old and sick and drunk. It's a pathetic scene. I said, where'd you get that from? And he said, oh, well, we just kind of made that up on the set. He said, it seemed like the kind of thing that Cobb would do.
The debunked stories notwithstanding, is it fair to say that Ty Cobb was not the easiest guy to play baseball against or even with?
It is fair to say that. He had this tremendous sense of propriety and where people were in the social strata and, you know, what relationship should be. If you're the customer, if you're the rookie, how you should act and how you should be. And if you violated that, you might wind up with a fight with him. Even in an age when people fought a whole lot, he was known as a fighter.
Just out of curiosity, have any of the people whose work you have essentially discredited with your book come forward to defend themselves?
Well, Stump is deceased. I had a brief conversation with Charles Alexander, not since the book came out. He was identifying people, several key people as black, who I found beyond a doubt were white that Cobb fought with and who became sort of the foundation stones of Cobb's reputation as a racist. I asked him where he got this information that they were black, and he said it was the best available information at the time. He sort of seemed to be saying, well, I was working before the internet. But it's a mystery to me because he's a good writer, Charles Alexander, and an esteemed university professor. I just don't know where that came from.
After all the time you have spent studying Ty Cobb's life, I'm curious about what you think about him today and whether you think maybe you've, righted a wrong that's been in, you know, the public memory for a long time.
Well, you know, I hope so, but I set out to tell a story about a great ball player. Someone once said, Ty Cobb getting a walk is more exciting than Babe Ruth hitting a home run. And I know what they mean. Cobb didn't tell a lot of jokes. He wasn't a guy you'd associate with a sense of humor. But he played with a wit and a sense of humor that was almost like a silent movie comedian. I mean, there's another occasion. Two guys on base. He hits a double. The two guys come home. The second guy is a close play. It's against the Yankees. And the umpire says safe. All the Yankees get mad and start running in and arguing with the umpire. Cobb's standing on second. He traipses down to third. The guys are still fighting. He looks around. He comes home. He sticks his leg in between all the guys who are standing at home plate fighting with the umpire. And he scored. It turned out to be the winning run. He was a delightful guy to watch, whatever you thought about him.
Charles Learson is the author of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been my pleasure, Bill.
Growing up in New Jersey, Madison Hollerin was well-liked, a good student, and a star high school athlete. Hollerin enrolled at the University of Pennsylvania, where she ran track. To the outside world, she seemed happy, but she was struggling more than anybody knew. ESPN's Kate Fagan wrote about Madison Hollerin's life and death for ESPN the magazine. Social media and how it affected Madison's view of the world were a big part of that story, and the article has generated a conversation about suicide. Kate Fagan joins me now. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Madison Hollerin's childhood, Kate.
Happy. Really happy. It just sounds like she was a really driven kid, sometimes quiet, but really, really happy. And so that was, of course, the backdrop to what really resonated with me about telling this story was, you know, there were very, very few warning signs as she was growing up.
When she arrived at Penn, the dream of a positive and enjoyable college experience did not materialize. What went wrong?
You know, I think the key thing to remember is all of this is against the backdrop of a young woman who clearly was suffering depression. Everything that she was seeing and feeling seemed to be skewed by the mental illness that she was suffering from, because she was so stressed about grades and she kept telling her friends and family that she thought she was failing out of Penn, and she ended up getting a 3.5. And she thought running was not going the way she wanted. And this was someone who won the New Jersey State Championships in the 800s. And, you know, talking to her coach, she was his strongest freshman runner. So everything wasn't perfect for her that first year, but nothing that really could make sense of the decision she made.
Madison Holleran was very active on the social media photo sharing site Instagram. How did she present herself on Instagram, and how did the way her friends presented themselves factor into her depression?
It paints a picture of what everyone probably thought of who knew her as a 19-year-old just loving the college experience. The thing that really struck me and made me want to dive into the social media aspect of this was that Stacy Holleran, Madison's mom, remembers asking her daughter at Penn, like, but Madison, like, you look so happy in this picture, because Madison had just posted one from, I think, a party at Penn. And Madison was like, Mom, that's just a picture. So there was some level that Madison knew she was curating her Instagram and that it wasn't showing the gray areas and the sad moments. And I think there's a parallel to be made between how we curate our online lives and put these filters and make everything seem perfect, and how oftentimes people who suffer from depression or mental illnesses are often also encouraged to put on, you know, a happy face or seem like everything's okay.
I want to turn to the reaction that your story has been getting, particularly on social media. Your Twitter feed is dotted with people responding and using the hashtag LifeUnfiltered. Tell us a little about what people have been saying in that context.
The key connection we tried to make in this story was that this is not about blaming social media or saying, you know, there's something wrong with the lives we present on social media. It's simply verbalizing for people that sometimes when you look at someone's Instagram, it's not the whole story. We know we're not just going to jump to a place where everybody's constantly posting their unedited thoughts, and because that's just not how our society has worked. But we were hoping to open the door to at least being very deliberate about saying, hey, social media and my Instagram feed is not my whole story. Just please keep that in mind as you look at that.
Kate, your article appeared in the issue of ESPN, the magazine, titled Perfection. Madison struggled with striving for perfection. After working on this story, did you feel you had learned something about young athletes and young people in general who are trying to live up to a standard that's perhaps impossible?
I think I must have gotten maybe 40 or 50 emails from current college students who maybe were going through their freshman years or were juniors and were just thinking back on their freshman years. And they didn't feel like they could actually verbalize how much anxiety they felt about being in that new environment, how they had been told repeatedly, right, this is like the time of your life, and that they weren't feeling like it was the time of their life, but they didn't know that they could talk about that. And I think perhaps that is compounded for student athletes who are, many people will look at their lives and be like, they're so blessed and they're so lucky to be given that opportunity. But they're also dealing with the added stress of an athletic career that is morphed from sometimes fun into almost job-like in college. So that's what really struck me, was perhaps we're not talking enough about the anxiety. And for some people, it doesn't morph into depression. For others, it does, that young people face when they get to their freshman year on campus and sometimes even throughout college.
Kate Fagan is a writer for ESPN and ESPNW, and you can link to her article about the life and death of Madison Holleran titled Split Image at onlyagame.org. Kate, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, should the U.S. military pay pro sports teams to honor soldiers? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
This week, the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, fined the New England Patriots $1 million, and he took away two future draft picks, and he suspended Tom Brady for 4 games for Brady's alleged role in the so-called Deflategate scandal. So, did the punishment fit the crime, or was it inflated? I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, I saw that one coming. You just couldn't get out of the way. The 4 games is ridiculous. It's a 2-game suspension. This is the Eric Cartman School of Justice because, you know, basically this is about respecting Roger Goodell's authority. Uh-huh. That being said, the defense of the New England Patriots has gone from ludicrous to absolutely insane. When we are now arguing that the guy meant deflating as a term for losing weight.
That's not how you talk about losing weight. I've been using it for years.
Not being 90% helium, no.
This week, former New Orleans Saints linebacker Jonathan Vilma had some advice for Tom Brady. Basically, it was lawyer up and the league will revoke its punishment. The strategy worked for Vilma in the Bountygate scandal. The league dropped all disciplinary action against him. So, does it work for Brady?
I don't know. It's a different world now. Roger Goodell got burned very badly by his bungling of just about everything last year, especially the Ray Rice case. So I think the legal terrain is different from when Jonathan Vilma made his case. But, you know, lawyering up is never a terrible idea.
Especially for the lawyers.
Right.
According to official NFL merchandiser Fanatics.com, the sale of Brady merchandise doubled immediately after his suspension was announced. So good business strategy, eh?
It's amazing. He spent almost his entire career crafting this image, and now it turns out it's more profitable to be an outlaw. Who knew? Except practically everybody.
This week, Dr. Elizabeth Nabel, who was appointed the NFL's chief health and medical advisor a few months ago, said, "Football is safer than it ever has been, and if my kids were young enough, I would let them play." So they get the right person?
Well, certainly the right mouthpiece, yeah. I mean, but football being safer than it's ever been is kind of a low bar. We're still dealing with what football used to be. We won't know how safe it really is until some of these players are 40 and 50 years old and on their third hip transplant.
The Cleveland Cavaliers have made it to the conference finals. On Thursday, LeBron struggled, but the Cavs got strong performances from Matthew Dellavedova and Tristan Thompson to close out their series against Chicago. The development of the Cavs bench might suggest that they're rounding into championship form. What do you think?
I agree. They're getting contributions from everybody now. I saw the Cavaliers play earlier this season. They weren't getting anywhere near this level of bench contribution. It allows LeBron to husband his strength, which he did. You know, then he can, you know, unleash one of those 39-point explosions like he did in the game before last. They're a very dangerous person, as Rocky's manager used to say.
The New York Rangers, winners of the 2015 President's Trophy for best regular season record in the NHL, survived a 7-game series against Washington. They're on to the Eastern Conference Finals. Do you think they'll be soon lifting the cup for the first time in 21 years?
No, I don't think so. I'm completely on the Tampa Bay Lightning bandwagon right now, having watched how easily they did away with Montreal's chances. I think the Rangers had a great series against Washington. They played a terrific Game 7, but Ben Bishop is turning into the rest of the league's revenge for the Canadians having brought up Ken Dryden.
Jorge Posada, late of the New York Yankees, has a book out, Charlie, and in an interview about that book, he said he did not think Roger Clemens or Alex Rodriguez should be voted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Does this make you want to show up for the Yankees Old Timers Day somewhere down the road?
It might actually be some fun. I hope Jorge doesn't think he's clearing the road to his own induction, though, by doing this, because he's still pretty far down the list. No, I mean, it's an opinion. It's an opinion held by a number of people I respect, and I thought Jorge Posada was a very, you know, likable and respectable ball player. So, I mean, Clemens will bellow something at some point, I'm sure.
On June 12th, the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame will officially name its South Rotunda after Pat Summitt. As head coach, Summitt led Tennessee to 8 national titles. She was prominent in getting the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame up and running. And by the way, it's in Knoxville, Tennessee. So was there any chance the hall would honor anybody else this way?
Well, no. I'm just wondering why she only got the rotunda.
She'd get the parking lot, too. Absolutely. Charlie, I have a riddle for you. You ready?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, what's five times worse than a mixed martial arts bout?
You carry the five, divide by six. But Bill, would that be five mixed martial arts bouts in the same night?
In the same time, in the same place.
That's it's a pentagon of octagons.
I'm glad we've settled that because it's been troubling me all week long. And finally, Stephen Hawking and David Beckham became acquainted this week, and Dr. Hawking allowed us how he and Beckham have been competing against each other for years. How is that?
Apparently, and this is, you know, shows you how far the empire has fallen, there's only room for one British icon at a time, apparently, and they go back and forth holding the title of British icon. And, of course, it's an even match now because they both have roughly the same relevance to high-level soccer.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week here on Only a Game as well. Charlie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
On Friday, the U.S. House passed a bill rejecting what lawmakers are calling paid-for patriotism. The decision follows the release of a report on government waste submitted by Arizona Senator John McCain. That report took note of the $49 million the National Guard paid for professional sports sponsorship in 2014. NJ.com has also reported that the first item in the advertising contract between the New York Jets and the New Jersey National Guard includes the team's hometown hero segment, which involves a service person appearing on the field and being introduced as the fans stand and cheer. It's supposed to be a feel-good moment, but should it be one that's bought and sold? We decided to ask somebody who knows what it's like to be honored at a major sporting event. Michael Segan is on the line. Mike, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
You're in the private sector now, but you served in the Army from 2001 until 2007. Tell me about the nature of your service.
Yes, I was a captain in the infantry throughout my 5.5 years in the service. I was deployed to Iraq two different times. First time was about 16 months, then the second time almost 12 months to the day.
Now, I assume that you did not join the Army because you thought you might someday be chosen to be honored on the field at a Chicago Cubs game.
That is correct. I initially joined the Army to go to West Point and then to give back to my country. My friends and I have season tickets to the Chicago Cubs, mm-hmm. and we see on a regular basis every game the Cubs honor someone at the end of the fourth inning. And my good friend Zach Williams, who's been a great supporter of mine from day one, nominated me, and I was honored a couple Wednesdays ago, the 29th of April.
And so at the end of the fourth inning, you stood up in front of all the fans at Wrigley Field and you listened to a 30-second biography of your military service, and you were cheered on by all the Cubs fans in attendance. How was it?
It was fantastic. It felt great, you know, to have 30,000 plus standing up and cheering and thanking for my service. It was a special moment that I will take with me.
Now, Mike, we asked the Cubs if they have taken sponsorship dollars for their segment honoring military personnel and veterans. They haven't gotten back to us with an answer to that yet, but the Cubs do not appear on any of the lists we've seen of teams that received money for this sort of thing. If it turns out that the Cubs did take money to honor you, would you feel any less honored?
It does cheapen it a bit, you know, in a weird way. You know, for them profiting off of that recognition, does seem to be a little bit, disingenuous of their actions there.
Lots of teams are now saying that the money they received was to cover advertising for recruitment efforts and that the on-the-field tributes to soldiers and veterans, that was something they did for free. Who do you believe in all this?
You know, I'm not inclined to believe the NFL teams or the other teams that take the money. I think money trumps all this day and age, and that, you know, if they find a way to exploit the DOD or to gain money, I think they're going to take it.
I have one last question for you, Mike. I'm a bit uncomfortable with the close relationship between sports and the military, in part because advertising during games can make it seem like joining the military is just a variation on playing a game in front of adoring fans. Before this week's disclosures, did the links between sports and the military ever bother you?
It didn't bother me, but I think I was always able to separate playing a game and being in the military and being in the Army. There are clear links, and I think you see it in the metaphors the announcers use when announcing professional sports, but the military is at such a different level with such a higher commitment that I was always able to separate those. I'm not sure if the average teenager weighing his future options can separate those as easily, though.
Mike Segan retired as a captain from the U.S. Army, and he's also a Chicago Cubs fan. He was honored by the Cubs a couple of weeks ago. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for the time today. I appreciate it.
Okay, sports fans, what's an Unterklätzl? How about a Puderplätzl or a Bankala? All of these are Yiddish street fighting terms from the 1920s. Eddie Portnoy teaches Yiddish at Rutgers University and specializes in studying the underbelly of Jewish culture. He recently kibitzed with reporter John Kalish.
Eddie Portnoy has been reading Yiddish daily newspapers from Warsaw on microfiche for the last 15 years. He started doing it when he was working on his doctoral dissertation about comic strips in the Yiddish press. During the hours and hours he spent scrolling through the three Yiddish dailies, Portnoy would roll to the Friday edition of the papers to read the comics. But he often got distracted by items that were published earlier in the week. That's how we came upon a column covering Warsaw's rabbinical courts, where a group of three rabbis settled domestic and business disputes using traditional Jewish law.
This was kind of like a Yiddish version of Jerry Springer. There are cases where all the furniture's broken, people smash chairs over each other's heads.
One case involved a Jewish man who married two Jewish women, only to be exposed by his own brother. When the rabbinical court issued its decision, it was time to rumble.
The rabbis determined that the man had to divorce both women. When the rabbis handed the man the judgment, finalizing the divorce, his brother ran over to him and punched him in the face. When that happened, the 30 women from the first wife's family jumped on the second wife and began to beat her mercilessly. The rabbinical court was filled with spasmodic wails. The rabbis ran out, got the Polish police, who came in and arrested everyone.
That wasn't the only kind of physical conflict Portnoy stumbled upon doing research into early 20th century Poland. He was surprised to find that religious Jews were fans of the Warsaw wrestling scene.
I stumbled across cartoons from the mid-1920s in the Warsaw Yiddish press that used wrestling as a metaphor. And I thought that's a weird metaphor to use. And my question was, what did Warsaw Jews know about wrestling in the mid-1920s? So I started to look in the back pages of these newspapers, and I started to find reports of the wrestling matches from the previous night and announcements of matches to come, you know, the fact that there were Jewish wrestlers involved. And I stopped working on my dissertation and focused entirely on wrestling for a whole semester and wound up writing an article about wrestling in Poland between the two world wars. I guess I'm a very distracted person, and when I do research, I always find things that are of interest for future use.
Portnoy recently made additional use of the material on wrestling in Poland in an exhibit he curated titled Yiddish Fight Club. It's currently on display at the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research in Manhattan. The exhibit also includes the stories of celebrated Jewish boxers, as well as a list of Yiddish street fighting terms compiled in 1925. Terms like dos lempel,
which is the little lamp, and that's when you squeeze the victim's nose with your forefinger and thumb, you make their nose red. If you're able to squeeze snot out through their nose, it's called die Lichterlach, or the little lights.
Kind of reminds you of the Three Stooges, doesn't it? Barne is the Yiddish term for a noogie. One Yiddish phrase translates literally to take out a mortgage on someone.
Arois nemen a mashkante afemitzen. That usually requires a few people. And it's just a situation where someone is held down and beaten. It's ultimately what the bank does to you when you take out a mortgage. They hold you down and beat you. All of this vocabulary developed because of Jewish street fighting. You know, there had to be terms in Yiddish created in order to explain these things. All languages have this. People just don't expect that Yiddish has these kind of phrases.
When he's not curating exhibits at the YIVO Institute, Portnoy teaches Yiddish at Rutgers University. At his home in Harlem, there are images of his favorite Jewish boxers and wrestlers. Portnoy is especially keen on a wrestler named Martin Levy. While we spoke, I glanced down at his desk and noticed there was a picture of Levy reproduced on Portnoy's iPhone case. The wrestler is wearing a unitard and has his arms extended as if he's about to pounce on an opponent.
He's a great character. I mean, he's a tragic character.
Known as Blimp Levy, the Boston native weighed more than 600 pounds and was a major attraction on the wrestling circuit in the 1930s and 40s. That was more than a half century before WWE star Bill Goldberg proved that Jewish wrestler is not an oxymoron.
In high school, he played football, but was removed from the team after falling on opposing players and breaking their legs.
Blimp Levy was working as a fat man at a circus when he was discovered by wrestling promoter Jack Pfeffer in the mid-1930s. Pfeffer approached pro wrestling as more of a theater art than a sport. He built up a stable of wrestlers with freakish physical traits and personas. The bug-eyed Levy fit in well. One New York newspaper described him as the most meat which ever stepped into a ring, but Blimp Levy was surprisingly nimble.
He hung up a tin can in the locker room about 5 or 6 feet off the ground and was able to jump up and kick it, and no one else could do it. So it was Blimp Levy's way of proving to the other wrestlers that he actually did have athletic ability. Blimp worked as a regular wrestler. He had lots of matches with lots of champions and great wrestlers and did relatively well. He wrestled all over the country and really all over the world.
By the mid-1940s, Blimp Levy's health was beginning to fail. The Connecticut State Athletic Commission revoked his license on the recommendation of physicians. Levy's career ended around 1950, and he died in an Alabama trailer park at the age of 56, weighing 900 pounds. Larger-than-life photos of Blimp Levy and other Jewish wrestlers and boxers have been reproduced on a 40-foot wall as part of the Yiddish Fight Club exhibit at the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research in Manhattan. The exhibit runs through the summer. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from George Hicks and John Perotti. And we welcome our new intern, Joe Jacobs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Yiddish Fight Club curator Eddie Portnoy, who translates yet another fantastic Yiddish fighting term.
Der Gubernator, the governor. That is to take one's thumb and jam it into someone's ribcage.
Oy vey, that schmerz, also hurts. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.